over the past 2 years, we've all been starved for connection with those who live outside of our homes and maybe overindulged in the connections with those in our homes. Sorry, Brinkley. The kind of isolation the entire planet has experienced helped us to recognize the value in collaboration, camaraderie, and the exchange of ideas. As the world has begun to reopen and close and reopen again, now more than ever, we're searching for what it is we want to contribute to society, who we are as individuals, and where we truly belong. My conversation with Justin Salhani feels like it was a long time coming. Though Justin and I don't know each other too well, he brings an honesty and an openness in sharing his story, not just in retracing his career path, but in sharing what it is he's searching for and trying to build in this world. This is the final episode of this season of Don't Talk to Me About Work, and it's called Community. Okay, so I always start this podcast with the very same question. What is your earliest childhood memory of someone asking you what you would like to be when you grew up?
I really don't remember. I mean, I know what I can say is that I know there was something that I wanted to be when I was a kid, like, kind of ashamed to say, like, probably, you know, these things that kids always want to be, police officer, fireman, whatever, certain kids want to be anyways. But the one that really stuck around was footballer, like soccer player. That was something that I held on to probably way too late in life. But like, that was something I always dreamed of being. So like from age 7 till my mid 20s, like that was something that like was a dream dancing around inside my head. And can I also just like do a disclaimer that the police officer thing is something so opposed to like my personality and political views and way of living and everything today. So
I actually have a theory, because a lot of people on this podcast have said firefighter and things like that. I think that when we are children, and I'm curious about how it is globally, but jobs that come with a specific costume seem to be more attractive. So like a doctor, right? You can get a kit that has like a coat and a little stethoscope, right? Or a police officer comes with like a vest and a utility belt, and firefighters the same thing. Or ballerina, whether dance has ever been an interest to you, it's something you could put on a tutu and pretend that you're a ballerina. So I think a lot of jobs that come with some kind of costume where you could dress up and pretend to be that thing seem to be attractive for very small children versus something like lawyer, right? Like what costume, a briefcase? That's kind of boring. So I'm not judging you based on your childhood aspirations. I think it usually has something to do with what can we dress up for Halloween as?
Right. I think it also probably has something to do with like popular representation. You know, like I'm sure when I was a kid, my dad put something on TV and then it was like, oh, that looks awesome. I want to do that. And then, you know, but as soon as I was able to kind of like shape and form what my future was going to look like and what I wanted to be, I think it was, yeah, it was pretty much a soccer player. And I don't know, I think it was really related to the fact that you're putting on for such a large audience, but also that people seem to care so much about it. You know, like you have crazy, I mean, there's obviously tons of people who don't give a shit one way or the other about soccer, but like, you know, there's so many people around the world from so many different class, race, gender, social status, you know, you have these deep intellectuals that when it comes to soccer, they just like lose their mind. You know what I mean? They become completely different people, and the emotions that you feel playing, but also watching and just being involved in that. And I think that doing something that I thought at that age was so important and felt so impactful because the stories around them, at least in your mind as a kid, you know, they last so long, they resonate so much. I think that was maybe more than the other, like everything else, as well as it was like fun and, you know, being in a job where you don't have to go sit at a desk and stare at a computer all day, because I didn't know what that entails, even though that's what I do now. You know, I thought, I guess those were the things that were coming together when you're young, right?
Okay. I'm going to try rephrasing my first question to see if we get a slightly different thought process here, because as a warning, we could talk about football forever because I have so many questions. As a much newer football fan, I could totally derail this whole podcast. I'm going to try not to do that. When you were younger, what was your worldview on what work was, right? The adults in your life around you and their relationships to work. And how do you think that influenced you as you were growing up?
That's such a great question, because I mostly grew up in the DC area. Work for me was you wake up early. And this would be very much based on my dad, because at this time, you know, my mom had odd jobs around that period, but most of the time she was a stay-at-home mom, you know, which is a job in and of itself. But that's, you know, society doesn't tell you that that's work. So to me, work was like, okay, you wake up early, you put on a suit, you get in a car and you drive into the city. And then, you know, I would go see my dad downtown sometimes. I liked that part of like being in the city and moving through spaces. And I thought that was cool. But I think a lot of it seemed to be sitting at a desk, waiting for things to happen. And obviously this is like, you know, the early mid 90s. So things have, technologically speaking, amplified, intensified. I guess it's hard to kind of connect that to today. But to me, yeah, it was probably, you put on a suit, you go sit at a desk. It's not that much fun. My dad really loved his job for most of his life, but I think at that time he was probably pretty unhappy. And I think that might have shaped me as well to really push and want to be something outside the sphere of wear a suit, go sit in a box. I do think that children are able to develop more complex ideas than man wears clothes, goes sit in room. You know, I'm trying to like think of what I was seeing it at that time. But I also, I think as well, like I thought my dad had a level of importance at that time. I thought he had a level of status. My understanding was that took a lot of struggle, sacrifice. He worked really hard to get there. He reached a certain level that most people in their careers don't reach. I thought as well, like, wow, that might be something that I'm not sure that I can achieve. I don't think I had the confidence at that point that I was able to achieve that as well. So I kind of saw that is like the better side. And so I think as a younger person, younger version of myself, I saw work as like something I was pretty sure I wasn't going to enjoy in my life.
That's so interesting. Nobody's ever said that on the podcast before, but I feel like we all thought it at some point where it's like, oh, work is the part of your life when you become an adult and they chain you to a desk until you get old.
Right.
So did your parents encourage this idea of being a footballer?
Not really. I mean, my parents were kind of like, you know, on the one side, you can do anything you want to do. But on the other side, they were more practical in a lot of ways. You know, my mom encouraged me, you know, if you're a doctor, if you're a lawyer, you can, you know, like at least get your, like they were really like, get your education. You know, if I'm being completely honest, they weren't always super involved either. And I think there's a lot of family dynamics going on there, but I wouldn't, like, they were encouraging in the sense that they paid for my soccer, they paid for my football, you know, they, when I couldn't drive, they'd take me to games, they'd take me to practices and stuff like that. You know, it was like a family effort, and I appreciate that a lot. But I don't think either of them genuinely considered supporting me. You know, I think my dad gave me feedback at times and advice like, you know, Europe is the place to go for this. I also don't think either of them really had the knowledge. So I'll give you an example. Like I live in Paris now, but at the time I didn't. So we're talking 2 years ago in 2019. And so it was the Women's World Cup in France. And I was invited to an event hosted by Puma and Copa 90, where Ada Hegenberg was speaking. And she was at the time the women's Ballon d'Or winner. And they talked a lot to her about like her upcoming and her upbringing and all this stuff. And she spoke so much about her family. She came from a family of athletes. You know, she had incredible support. Every offseason, her dad and her trained on everything. Like for the most part, I was always training and playing alone or like with kids in the neighborhood or stuff like that, right? But to become a professional athlete, especially an elite one, need such a strong support network. And I had a support network in the sense that, yeah, you know, they took me to trainings and stuff. I didn't in the sense that like, and again, I think this was like a lack of knowledge on their part. I think some parents see that and they go out and they're really aggressive and they try to do that. And I'm not faulting my parents for this. It's just the way it kind of shook out. You know what I mean? So I think that like that sort of network learning, like, okay, what coaches do you need to be with, spending the money to get there, you know, and it is kind of a, I would say that financially we were fine, but we weren't at that level to be throwing money at private trainings and doing all these sort of summer camps and sleepaway camps and all these sort of things that may have benefited. I'll also say that I don't know if emotionally I was mature enough to be able to handle that. They weren't against the idea, but they weren't able to help me realize the idea, if that makes sense. So I'm not saying that to lay it at their feet. Like I was never a professional footballer because my parents didn't support me. I think there's a lot of other factors going into that. They were supportive in a sense of like, we're not putting pressure on you to become something you don't want to be. But a lot of it was also leaving me to kind of figure things out, which I think has positives and also at times can have negatives, you know?
So one of the things when we talk about the influence of our parents on us as we're growing up that we forget about is that your parents aren't the only adults in your life. And sometimes in a lot of these conversations, there'll be another adult, usually an educator, who sometimes it's an encouragement or a suggestion that you hadn't thought about before. Sometimes it's like a guidance counselor who's like, yeah, you know how many people become a professional footballer? Can we maybe think about something else? Did you have an experience like that when you were growing up?
Yeah, I mean, that was basically my mom. But outside of that, not really. You know, I was never really that confident until I probably hit about 20. And then I was getting the sort of feedback and support where I felt like this is maybe something I could chase and do a bit more. But I mean, you know, speaking towards the careers that I actually did end up going into, I guess, to be quite honest, I've thought about this and I can't really look back and find like, you know, I had my mentor or the, you know, that movie moment where somebody said, why don't you try this? And I was like, hey, I guess I should give a bit of credit to a football coach that I did have when I was in Beirut. So when I moved to Beirut, like I was teaching at a school and then, I was playing for this team, kind of semi-professional or something. And the coach wanted me to stick around, but my contract had ended. And so I had accepted an offer to move to Dubai to work in a hotel. He looked at me, he said, what does your dad do for a living? And I was like, well, he's a journalist. He said, do you want to do journalism? And I was like, I don't know. Like, I guess I could. So he set up an interview and I went and met an editor at a local newspaper in Beirut. And then one thing led to another. He kind of said, you know, if you ever decide to leave Dubai, give me a shout. And I ended up, you know, doing that a few months later. And that kind of kicked off my career in journalism, which has kind of led to everything that I'm doing now, more or less. So yeah, in that sense, I guess I should give credit to this coach of mine, a guy named David Nackett. There really wasn't an individual person. I think some of that had to do, like, there's a lot of things going on there. I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that my parents had moved around a lot in their life. You know, my dad immigrated to the US. My mom, even though she was from the DC area, like she had moved around a lot when you're young in your 20s and early 30s and you talk about moving a lot, it seems really glamorous. Like, oh, I learned, you know, I picked up a few words of this language and I lived in this city and I had this great night and I had this great memory. One of the things people don't talk about is how that kind of ruptures your connections to people and kind of hurts community. Like today, okay, we have all these technologies to be able to stay in touch and I'm in touch with friends from Beirut and I'm in touch with friends from DC. But yeah, like that real connection with people kind of breaks. And so I think my parents experienced that and I experienced that as a kid. There wasn't like a big community around us all the time, at least a consistent one, you know, random friends dropping in and out and stuff like that. Sorry, I've lost track of my train of thought.
No, I think so. You've given me a bunch of things that I wrote down. So let's pull at some of these threads. So the first one that I just want to talk about is just school in general. So did you like school? Did you like? No. No.
I really didn't. And I think probably some of that is down to ADHD. Some of that is down to like class size. You know, I went to like pretty big schools. Some of that was probably because I've always just been a bit like different, I guess. You know, part of that maybe like living the first few years of my life in Europe, having a dad who's like Arab, but also not in a lot of ways. Like, you know, he's got a very diverse mixed background and was raised in a very cosmopolitan place. And then I'm growing up in a suburb where, you know, there is diversity, but not in the same way and not as much. And, you know, I hadn't figured out who I was or who my identity was. And I didn't really like school on a social level. I didn't really like school on a learning level. It's funny because as an adult, I've become like a voracious reader. I'm super fascinated. I always talk about now wanting to like go back and do a master's and stuff. But at the time, I think I was the type of person who wants real world experience. And then like I'll read about it to supplement and grow my thinking on something. And, you know, cause I remember beyond school going into university, and I don't want to jump ahead, but like, I just remember reading things and being like, I can't tie this to anything. I haven't lived. I have no experiences. Like when I talk about stories, I'm usually like pulling on other people's stories. Like I'm telling something that my dad did or something, you know, and I've not lived those stories. And so that's really how I felt a lot of the time. when I was in school. I felt like the world was so big and I'd experienced such a small part of it. And I've always wanted to do that. I've wanted to make my own path and do things my own way, sort of. So
did you go on to higher ed after high school?
I attended, I guess, three different schools. I started at Catholic University and I went for a semester. I had a partial scholarship and I was playing soccer there as well. I dropped down to community college for a year and a half and then went to George Mason where I got my BA.
So funny. We have the same story. That's so funny.
Does it sound familiar?
We'll have to do like a reverse version of this podcast someday.
I'd like to hear it. Yeah.
So I'm going to slightly editorialize your life because based on my own experience, I think there is a misconception in the United States that a community college education is a step backwards from being in a four-year school. It socially, it might be because it's harder to build relationships when you're not living with people. A commuter school, that's just totally different. Community college sometimes just takes the pressure off a little bit and gives you the opportunity to just focus on your classes or try different things a little bit more. Whereas in a four-year school, there's just the imminence of graduation rapidly moving towards you. Whereas like, and I know there were a lot of people out there who are like, that's not what it's a 2-year school. It's like, yeah, but some people are there for a long time while they're just figuring things out and they take like a class a semester or whatever. And I think it's an institution that should be utilized to, you know, the full width and breadth of its abilities. And so, yeah, sorry. I'm getting on a soapbox about community college, but I think it's awesome that that's something that you must have recognized something about Catholic University not being right for you and then making that decision, right?
Completely. I mean, my vision of going to school in DC would be that it would be quite diverse. And then maybe I would find myself a bit, you know, in terms of identity, in terms of background and all these sort of things. But like I went there and it just was the total opposite of that. And in fact, most of the friends that I had there didn't finish there. They ended up leaving within a year or two or things like that. It just wasn't the place for me. It wasn't the background for me. It was small, which can be okay. But anyway, when I transferred to a community college, because I have the same social stigma, I guess, I completely agree with what you have to say because one, I mean, most of those teachers are also teaching at 4-year universities. And I mean, we can like, of course, there's all threads about prestige and what they mean and versus the actual merit and all that sort of stuff. But my grades were never better than at community college. And it wasn't because classes were any easier. It was just that like, you're right. I had time to focus. I had time, you know, there were not other distractions in my life going on. And I was actually, I think I look back on those periods as like quite happy periods, even if there was maybe a bit of loneliness and like less social interaction. But like, you know, my grades were good. I found classes interesting at times. And then transferring to George Mason for the next year and a half or however long it took me to finish, 2 years and a half. Yeah, it's much more of a blur, you know? And it's not like, oh, I was partying all the time and stuff. Like, you know, I did some of that, but like, I just don't really remember engaging with my classes the same way. You know, there wasn't the same focus. And getting out, like I remember the last year or two, I was just really ready to be out into the world and gain experiences and get away from, you know, 18, 19 year olds and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm complete agreement on that.
So what is your degree in?
Global affairs.
Really?
Yeah, it's like a really kind of hodgepodge, pulls from a lot of different things. So it's a bit of politics, a bit of culture, a bit of this and that. And I think a lot of people who end up doing that go into like the think tank world or diplomacy or, you know, these sort of things. And to be honest, I kind of did that because I knew my world was kind of international. I didn't have like a clear career path. I still didn't really know what I wanted to do. I kind of figured, okay, when I graduate, I'll like travel a bit and try to get like odd jobs here and there. You know, obviously you don't really realize like the weight of capitalism and how hard that actually is to do. But, you know, I knew that like my parents had these experiences of being out in the world and before I could know anything, I needed to go do those sort of things. And I had people on the way try to tell me otherwise, like, you know, I was working as a soccer coach at the time. And my boss was saying, why don't you just become a gym teacher and then you can keep coaching soccer? And for him, it was the dream, you know, like he built up a career, he built up a thing and he made a great business out of it. But for me, I always wanted a bit, like maybe it's not fair to say more, but I just wanted something different.
It also sounds like, and this is just from listening to you talk, that you are still in search of identity, right? Because you said that growing up in different places, a lack of community, the lack of footballer because you have to assume that if somebody becomes you know, is on that trajectory for like big time footballer, millions of dollars contract kind of thing, that is the main part of their identity as they're growing up, right? You were talking about like their parents investing. I can't stop. And it's not football, but I can't stop thinking about Serena Williams when you're talking about things like that, right? Their parents, just Tiger Woods, like all that kind of stuff. So that wasn't where your identity was being based. Your parents come from an international background in the most general term. And that you, when you went to Catholic University, you felt like you were hoping to find it there and then you didn't. So it sounds like part of the reason maybe why you didn't settle when you graduated from college is because you still hadn't found that thing, that elusive thing yet.
Yeah. And I think, you know, look, identity is an ongoing thing. I'm still searching for that. I'm still exploring that. Identity in general, it's an imagined thing. Communities are imagined, nations are imagined, borders are imaginary, and they're things that we've made real in the certain sense. So yeah, and I don't think I'll stop doing that, but I definitely feel a lot more secure, certain, experienced than I did at that time. And now the path that I'm on is still sometimes blurred. You know, it's still difficult at times. I'm still fighting for community. I'm still trying to build things and, you know, dealing with all these sort of concepts and fears and anxieties and, you know, the lack of time we have to live and all these other things, mortality and whatnot. But yeah, I definitely think that at that point in time, you're dead on. It was like, I hadn't found my space. And, you know, like in a sense, I think the thing I've understood now is like, I may never find a place where I just walk in a door and it's like, everything is built for me and everyone understands me. But that's okay too. You know, like you can build those in different ways. It may not be a nation. It may not be a city. It may be a group of people sitting at a table. It may be, you know, a small coffee shop where I meet two or three people from time to time. It may be my life partner. It may be like so many other things. I wouldn't have found that if I wasn't able to kind of break out of what were like predetermined spaces that, or like, you know, the kind of narratives or pathways that I was told seemed reasonable. And I think it's really interesting, right? Because like growing up in kind of the DC area, you know, maybe this can go into a broader conversation about things like representation and whatnot, but like you kind of see the people in your life and you think those are the possibilities, right? And now being in the DC area, that's very different than somebody who's in New York or France or Japan or South Africa or Beirut or beyond, right? Because like different professions are attracted to different areas and all these other sort of things that shapes your mind and your possibilities as well. And so yeah, I think the world just felt so limited and small. And I wasn't sure that I would be able to break out of that, but I felt like I need to at least try and go see if I fit better somewhere else, you know?
We could literally have this conversation for like hours and hours because I've had this thought so many times about growing up in, you know, basically what was like the origin of suburbia in America, coming from Long Island. And my dad used to take a commuter train into New York City every day. And it's just like, that's what I thought being an adult was. And now I'm like flying to England 9 times in 3 years. And I'm like, no, that's not what life can be. All kinds of different things.
Right.
So, okay. You mentioned being in Beirut. So how do you get from George Mason halfway across the world?
There's a thing in Lebanon called Wasta, which is like a personal connection. And so, I mean, basically my dad knew somebody who was a school teacher and they hire like a teaching assistant every year. And so I had done like a TOEFL course or one of these things, kind of thought that will be my plan, is like when I finish, I don't know, I'll save up, like I'm saving up money and I'll go abroad and I'll try to find something teaching English. So I did an interview with this teacher and she liked me and was like, okay, I'm going to pass you on to the president of the institution. And then he was an American guy. So we met in DC and I signed a contract to move to Beirut for a year after I graduated. And so that's what took me over there in the first place. So I had essentially like the perfect setup. And this is very privileged and fortunate. That was basically like an apartment in a really great neighborhood in Beirut, like relatively a decent salary for coming straight out of school and particularly like, you know, the local currency and everything. And so that's what took me there. And then it was always a place that I'd wanted to visit more as well, because my dad grew up in Beirut and he's got Lebanese heritage, kind of. His mother is Polish-Romanian and was born in the Ottoman Empire and raised in Egypt. My dad was born in Egypt to a father who, like, we think is Lebanese, but his mother was Syrian. And then, you know, and these are also times when we're now getting to like before borders were established. And so it's kind of fluid, and the concept of borders as kind of like a European creation to establish states. We don't know a ton about my great-grandfather. He might have been Palestinian, he might have been Syrian, he might have been Lebanese, he might have been from this region, right? But anyways, like, my dad grew up in Beirut, and that's the place that he called home for a long time. He covered the civil war there, and then he left in the mid-80s before I was born. So he took me back once when I was 18, and I was just like totally out of my element. I don't know. It's hard to think back, you know? I remember reading this is gonna sound super pretentious, and I'm not even like a big Hemingway fan, but I remember reading a Hemingway quote that was something like, sometimes people ask me this thing or whatever, and his response is, there's not always a good answer. I got to Beirut through this job. You know, I've got a Lebanese last name. I've got Lebanese heritage. I didn't grow up speaking Arabic at all. But I think it was like, that was maybe part of the journey. It was like, can I figure out maybe what is a little bit different about my character that comes from my dad? And then if there's things that I can associate with that, I'll know kind of what comes from the US. I'll know what comes from the Lebanese side of things. And then maybe I'll understand myself a bit better as well as it just being an experience and something that would force me to do things differently. And it definitely was not as glamorous or as, you know, kind of adventurous as I thought it was going to be in some ways. In other ways, it absolutely was. But yeah, I mean, that's how I got there.
How long were you there?
About 5 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Was that the intention when you first signed the contract, or did it become something more once you got there?
Right. Okay. So, no, it was a 1 year contract. I had wanted to extend, even though I really didn't like the job. I just don't really like kids that much. Like, I like some kids, but not like that. And so it kind of put, you know, so I was informed probably in like February or something. So I'd been working for 6 months out of the 10-month school year or something like that, for, I don't know, somewhere around that period, that my contract would not be renewed the next year. It's a 1 year thing, and that's generally how it is and whatever. And I also think that it just was clearly not suiting me. So I don't know if normally if they think about extending it, but they were just like, you're not, sorry, guy, you're not going to work out here. But yeah, but I had really started to hit like a vibe in Beirut. Like, I started to make friends and I started to go out, and I really started to feel like this place really suits me in a lot of ways. It was really like still a very early period in terms of my like exploration of the city and the country and stuff like that. So there was that. And I just really liked living there and liked the people that I was meeting and liked how friendly people were. And, you know, I would just go out to a bar or something and then like make a bunch of friends, and people were easy to talk to and dynamic. And there was just like a lot of things happening, you know? And it was also a time, I have to say, like, you know, now it's really in a dark period. But at that point, there was, you know, people talk about these couple of years where there was just like a real optimism. A lot of the diaspora was moving back. A lot of dynamic, interesting, creative people were trying to, you know, start projects or businesses or tell stories or do all these sort of things. And so it was really cool to just be in a space where you'd like run into these sort of people. Cause again, like being from the DC area, there's a lot of people doing great things there, but I feel like it's a lot more of like, you really have to go looking for them. They're not as accessible and readily available, but like, you know, they're like, you're just out and your friend will be like, oh yeah, here's the guy who's in that band that's really famous in the area. And you're like, oh shit, like that's pretty cool. So that was great. And then, you know, of course, also I met someone and now we're married. Yeah, all those different things, sort of like having kind of a connection, feeling like I kind of belong to a city, felt really cool. It wasn't super smooth. You know, like, I have since then learned Arabic. It's broken. It's not fluent. I do okay. You know, there were times where I felt pretty confident in it, but like, it's quite clear pretty early speaking to me that like, I'm not somebody who was raised there, but I did feel like a connection and like a somewhat of a comfort in Beirut. I won't say in all of Lebanon, but in Beirut in particular, and particularly in certain neighborhoods. And yeah, and I think wanting to explore that more, as well as having met somebody who, you know, clearly, well, I mean, like we've been married for going on 5 years now, like was very special to me and stuff, and was really cool. Like I also learned a lot from her. And so she was, you know, she was more artistic than me. And so she taught me a lot and like showed me a lot of things, and we had like a really great dynamic. And so, yeah, I think for those things, I stayed then, you know, and then I started my career there basically as a journalist and as a reporter. There were other things at that time that also made me want to be there because I like had a good football team at first. But yeah, so I would say one was career. So, okay, if I rewind a little bit, I have that 1 year as a teacher. When that was ending, I had met this person. At that point, we weren't really dating. It was kind of friends and see what happened sort of thing. Not even see what happened. I was oblivious. She liked me a lot. I remember I like called her one day, like after I had had a like a football training on the weekend. I called her and I was like, yes, my contract is not being renewed, but I really want to stay here. And I was walking home from a place that like was pretty far from my house and I had not walked from there before. At one point I say to her, I'm like, you know, I'm really lost. And she's like, don't worry about it. Like, you know, we're going to figure this out and stuff. And I was like, no, like I'm literally lost. Like, I don't know what neighborhood I'm in. And she was like, oh, okay. But like, you know, it took her like two or three times of me repeating, no, like I'm not saying I'm like metaphysically or like, you know, like I'm geographically lost. So yeah. And it was cool. Like she helped me kind of work through that. And then, you know, when I got the job and I was moving back, we like decided to kind of make it official and date. And then, you know, it was the relationship kept me there, but it was also the career because I got into journalism and I got really excited by it. And it was a whole new world. And it was like perfect for me because I'm super curious. And so it was something where I'm always learning. I had an excuse to like go up and talk to people, you know? And if like something is happening in the street, my instinct is I want to go understand why. And I want to know what happened, you know? And most people like want to run away and find safety. And I'm kind of the idiot who's like, hey, what are you going to do with that thing that you're holding over your head about to hit me with? So I mean, like that sort of curiosity, and it was super cool. Cause like early on, I would think calling somebody on the phone and being, and asking them, hey, can I talk to you about something? They'd be like, you know, fuck out of here, man. I'm busy. But you'd be surprised how many people just want to speak. You know, they like, sure, let's talk. And you'd meet these very prominent people, or people would be talking about this book. And then I'd go up on Monday and call the person. They'd be like, yeah, come on, let's go talk about it. I'll meet you for a coffee or something. And so that was super fascinating. And it was just, you know, you publish a few stories and you make some connections and you build a bit of a network. And so I wanted to stay for a while and explore that route. So even when things, you know, I had to freelance for a while after that, you know, on jobs, off jobs, we went through some pretty rough periods with like suicide bombers, you know, in parts of the city and things like that. There was like a big assassination pretty close to my house at one point. I wasn't in the country when it happened. You know, like there was a number of things going on. It does have a wear on you though. It really does. And not just on me, but like on everybody. And I was somebody who was fortunate enough to have a passport that could leave. But yeah, so I mean, that's what kept me there for 5 years. And at some point I kind of felt like both me and my partner had hit our ceilings professionally. I mean, also the situation in the country wasn't really getting better. So we left in 2015. You know, like I said, 2010 was like a very vibrant period. 2011, Syrian civil war started, Syrian crisis that devolved into a civil war. And that made things in the region kind of a bit darker. And then 2012, 2013, things got a little bit worse. 2014, things were getting pretty bad, and on until we're today where things are really miserable after the pandemic, after the Beirut blast last year when the port exploded on August 4th. It's really, and now it's really dark. There's like a mass exodus. You know, we were lucky that we got out when we did. And there's been just like a repeated destruction of hope, which is one of the hardest things to deal with. Like even the Beirut that I lived in for that brief period, that 5 year period, it's not the same. Like it's really changed and it's really changing. You know, the currency is inflated to something like 8 to 10 times what it was. You know, and I've got this like nostalgic feeling for something that the city that maybe never really existed apart from like in little spurts and moments. So that's what kept me in Beirut for 5 years. Then, you know, I was on a pretty good career path and I think my career could have continued. I felt like I'd hit kind of a ceiling, not in terms of potential, because I think, you know, around 2014, I was a producer on a documentary that got some good attention for Vice News that was about Hezbollah, who is a local kind of militia / political party, and their fight against the Islamic State or ISIS, as well as how it was impacting Lebanon more generally. I mean, that got some good attention and stuff like that. And I had, you know, been there for a few years and written what I think are some decent stories and gotten in a few decent publications. And so I think I was on the path to something and I kind of burnt it all down to try to start again somewhere else. But I also think that there were many times where I just wasn't happy. I thought maybe if I get to the next step, I'll be happy. But then I remember I kind of like readjusted one day and went through like to some therapy and talked about this and was like, if I'm not happy now, will I be happy in 5 years when I'm working for a better publication where there's more pressure, but it's like the same sort of stuff? And so that's when I kind of made a decision and I talked to my partner and we agreed together like, okay, let's go somewhere else. And we had these like kind of big ambitious plans to go traveling, but we kind of settled on DC because it was kind of safe because, you know, I had friends there. She had a friend that had moved there as well. We had more connections. You know, when you've been a journalist in the Middle East, DC is like a very kind of natural next step.
You just referred to DC in 2015 as safe, which is insane to me to think that you would move from Beirut looking for, like, again, you use the word safe place, and then Donald Trump was elected president in the fall of 2016.
Yeah.
And this country became, in my opinion, like unrecognizable to what it had been before. And DC in particular, because I moved to DC in 2015. And it was like a really wild thing because I remember it was super naive of me. And it definitely came from a place of privilege where I was like, we're going to elect the first woman president. Yeah. And then I woke up the day after election day and was like, oh my God, what happened? I was just so sure and I didn't do my part. You know, I did a lot more the second time around. Let's put it that way. But also just a question that I want to ask quickly, and I'm not looking to make this like a therapy podcast or anything, but did you ever, while you were in Beirut and things were changing, did you ever think about pursuing a career closer to what your dad had done? Because it kind of sounds like, and maybe I'm misunderstanding, it's totally possible, but it kind of sounds like you were in a place where like a war correspondent could have flourished, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of on that path. I was doing similar things though in a bit of a different way. You know, my dad started off as a photographer and he was a local at that time. So, I mean, there's a different level of maybe prestige and privilege granted as well. Like I had more of a connection with the outside world though, because he grew up in like, and he was taking photos in the war and his English was fluent and his French was fluent. Like, you know, being in the middle of a war zone, like as horrible as that is for so many people, like as a professional photographer, you know, your images are super impactful. And so it shoots up. Whereas like stories I was covering were a lot less impactful. And I was also primarily a writer. Which is different as well. So there's obviously pluses and minuses there, but I was very much on that track and I was wanting to get into like conflict reporting and stuff like that, which I kind of did a little bit of. I think the thing that really kind of turned me off to that was that I had one experience that was not intended whatsoever, but I ended up being caught in a battle. I got wounded in a car accident as we were trying to like leave the battle. I ended up staying overnight in a stranger's building, you know, with like I had cut open my eye. So like my eye was bleeding and I had to get stitches the next day. It wasn't so much that for me necessarily, but it was when I got back to like, when I finally, you know, like I got picked up by an ambulance that raced me down to the hospital. I wasn't like in life, you know, like I showed them that I had like a cut and so they took me down and took me to the hospital. And from there I was safe and got a ride back up to Beirut because it was a bit in the south. But it was more so when I got home and then I saw the effect that it had on my partner at the time. Mm-hmm. Like it had a real effect, personal effect on her. And I could see how it affected her, and not just her, but like her family. Weirdly. And then like I talked to my dad about it after. And here's the thing as well, is that when I was very young, when I was like, you know, maybe young enough to not be making too many memories, my dad covered the first Iraq war, the Gulf War. I was really mad at him at that time. You know, like I wouldn't speak to him on the phone and all this sort of stuff. And I just, because all I knew as a kid was like war, people get killed in war. It's very bad. So why are you going? Or shouldn't you stay here with me? And so I was like really upset with him. And thankfully that's the last war he went to. But you know, he told me these stories growing up of how romantic in a way. And I think some of these stories are a bit, maybe can be reflected on a bit callously as well. Like, you know, these were really great times for him that he remembers really well because professionally he was doing incredible. You know, he was in his youth, he was in his peak and all this sort of stuff. I look back at those memories and, you know, when I would tell like journalist buddies, like this is what happened to me, sometimes they'd be like, that's incredible. I can't believe I wasn't there. And I thought, this is kind of sick. Not just the effect, like, and I thought about young kid me. I thought about, you know, my partner who, if I want to have a life with, like, that's not fair to them. And I thought, and I also remember like a few months after driving by and we saw this like poster that was up. And it was a poster of a Lebanese soldier who had been killed in that battle. I remember just being like, what did he die for? You know, like me, I'm sure maybe his family feels, I mean, I'm sure they're proud of him, but I'm sure it's not this thing of amazing. We lost somebody and he's a martyr and, you know, whatever. I'm sure they'd rather have, you know, their loved one with them. And maybe there's a way to justify that or something like that. But I felt like it was, you know, the battle was such a like nonsense political argument that evolved into shooting and people died. And it, like, it was really something that, you know, while there might have been legitimate grievances, like, I just, you know, to tie that into everything else that was happening in Lebanon at the time and what effect it had and how it changed nothing. And, you know, I just felt like this poor guy like died for nothing. You know, he was doing a job you know, I'm not like a patriot and a war, like an army supporter by any means, but like, you know, in Lebanon as well as in the US, really, like most people who join the, in most nations, people who join the armed forces are tend to come from working or lower class families, right? And so this guy is put out in the front line and ends up being killed for what? And I thought that, you know, do I want to die for this? So what? So the next day somebody can pick up my pen and keep doing it? And like, is it worth it? So yeah, I mean, that was something that had happened to me. Now, after that, and I realized, okay, I don't want to go into Syria. I don't want to, you know, this was also a time when we're talking guys like Stephen Sotloff and I believe it's Jim Foley, you know, they were decapitated by ISIS. Like, this is not something I want to happen, not just for me, but for my loved ones. And so that's when, you know, all these things kind of coming together, or when we decided to come to DC. And now this was before Trump announced his candidacy and all this stuff as well. I mean, the US has had numerous issues well before Trump. I think Trump is more of like a symptom than a, you know, the cause. When I did come back, I did think about, you know, coming back to your question here, wanting to follow my dad's footsteps. I thought, no, I don't want to become like an analyst or a think tanker or like, you know, be in this very Washingtonian world. And I thought I want to do it in a very different way, which is like, I want to cover local stories. I want to talk to people. I want to get like out in the street. Like, I don't want to do prestige stuff. I want to like really give a voice to people. Unfortunately, the job I landed didn't really provide me that opportunity. And to be honest, I was also kind of reaching a point of burnout, I think, in retrospect. So yeah, so it didn't really pan out that way in the end.
Did you come back to football while you were in DC?
I did. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that really speaks to like, again, community, but also surrounding circumstance, things like that. Because in Beirut, the friends that I had built and stuff, there were some that were into football, but it was more of like a political world. It was more like, you know, the people I was meeting were kind of media, journalism, but also kind of other spheres. But it was always like, we're talking about what's happening, because there's always something happening. Kind of similar to DC, because, you know, people in DC are always talking politics the way that in like California, they don't necessarily. So there is kind of a line like that. There's just always something happening. So people are always discussing politics or events or social change or activism or whatever it may be, which is really, it can get really tiring, but it can also be really like life affirming. So being in DC and being around old friends, like I did find football again. And so that was interesting. You know, I'd sworn it off, but then like, and it was kind of a slow process, because when I'd come back to visit a couple of times before, guys would be like, come play. And I'd be like, all right. And then I would actually have fun and find myself being able to express myself on the field and stuff like that. And so I thought, all right, you know, now that I'm back, why don't I get back into this? And friends would invite me out to teams and stuff. And then about, I guess I want to say like a little less than a year or about a year into having moved back, I really hit a wall. And I felt like a really deep depression. And I think a lot of that had stemmed from when I was in Beirut, like, you know, not every moment was great, but I felt like I had a purpose of sorts, like a drive, like I had a career path. And I felt like that had ended. And I wasn't proud of the work that I was doing, if I'm being honest. It just wasn't a good fit. You know, no shade to the place that was employing me. It just wasn't a good fit. And I thought about like, what do I need here? Like, what am I missing? And I started to ask these questions and I really didn't have answers. But one thing that I thought about doing was starting like a footballing project. And it kind of came as a slow roll over time. And this is what became what is now called Guerrilla FC, which I guess if you don't know, or if anybody else doesn't know, it's the best way to describe it today would be it's a creative collective. And we've got kind of a, like a streetwear brand that's between football culture and streetwear, you know, that kind of matches this football lifestyle. And we've done other projects and thrown events, and we've got a team or two on the side. We used to throw a weekly futsal game in Petworth. But it started off as like saying, let's build a team. And then we had some friends show us different things that were happening in the football space. Like I had a friend that was playing for a team up in New York that was doing really creative things. They showed me some stuff in Paris that was going on, things in Milan, things in Tokyo, things in Seoul. And we said, cool, like, why don't we do something like that that fits our narrative? That's a bit rebellious, that's a bit subversive, you know, and a bit intellectual, if I can call it that. And so we did that. So I started a team that kind of built into a community, and we started to attract these really interesting people. And that's when I really got to dive into like the subcultures of DC, the art side, and all this like really illuminating, you know, activism that's not just mainstream political activism that can also be really important. You know, that maybe spoke to me more personally as well. Those two pieces of my life have kind of been the launchpad that have led me into everything that I'm doing now.
So what are you doing now?
Yeah. So now I like my day job is I still run Guerrilla kind of on the side. It's kind of rolled back a bit, but we're working on some interesting projects that will hopefully be released later this year. I work predominantly for a video production platform that focuses on football as well as basketball. Right now, I'm the head of a team, it's the investigations team that will soon be relaunching the show that I also host, and it'll have a new branding and a new name and everything like that will be kind of built around me and my personality and my everything leading up to now. But essentially what we do is look at footballing issues, typically ones that happen off the pitch. We do a bit of both, a bit of everything, but we take like big questions and kind of do some interviews, talk to experts, and then dive deep into it. Things that I've liked the best that we've explored are things related to like sports washing, things related to, you know, dual identity or the binary of nationality and claiming an identity or feeling an identity, culture, etc. But that's basically it, is like making 8 to 10 minute videos for this bigger company on issues in and around football that intersect with things like politics, culture, society, etc.
It's so interesting to hear you tell your story and then think back to like the video about what's happening in Qatar right now, because that it's really like all of the things coming together in one place. And it makes so much sense that you would be creating something like that, which is super informative and super important that people have this information before they start making decisions about whether or not this is an event they want to attend and support and all that kind of thing. So it makes so much sense after hearing where you came from to get to a place like this now.
Yeah. I mean, first off, thanks for watching that one in particular. I think that one's one that I feel was like an important story. The other thing I have to say about that is that, you know, I owe my partner Karin so much for encouraging me and supporting me and telling me to try new things that were uncomfortable a lot of the time. And lastly, like, it's going to sound super corny. I know this isn't like an award show or anything, but like, but like, you know, my boss, who's a guy named Max, who's the best boss I've ever had. I may end up sending this to him. That's not why I'm saying it though. He's quite a few years younger than me, but he's by far like the best boss I've ever had. And I say that because like, he's somebody who recognized that and then kind of said, run with this. You know, you've got this experience, you've got this experience, you know this, put that together into this. And to be honest, like if I told you even maybe like less than a year ago that I would be doing what I'm doing now with the platform and with, you know, the freedom to, you know, I mean, there is a process and everything like that. It's not like I have total freedom to do whatever I want, but like, you know, to have the support and the institutional support and, you know, good feedback and patience to do the sort of, tell the sort of stories that I'm trying to tell. Like it's just, it's really incredible. And I owe him a lot. And again, I owe my partner a lot for like each way along the way, not telling me stick to your lane. But when I said, hey, I'm going to stop writing for a while and I'm going to do football creative stuff and we're going to throw an exhibit and I'm going to put time on it and it may not make a ton of money. And her saying, yeah, like I'm completely with you. What can I do to help? Like I'm very privileged in that sense. You know, like there have been times in my life where I've really had to, you know, like hustle and make money and do things to get by. And I've had times where, you know, I've had a bit of help like from her, you know? Yeah. I just want to qualify that as well.
I think that also speaks to a certain degree to that sense of community, right? Like, so you have something like Gorilla, which is definitely a community, but also that you recognize that community isn't necessarily like a big group of people who all live in the same place. It's just the people who support you and who help kind of lift you up and lift each other up so that when they lift you up, you can bring them with you too. And I think that that's in the truest form to me, that's what community really is.
Absolutely. And you know, like growing up, I went through these things. Like I wasn't like all the other American kids. And then, you know, I moved to Beirut and I wasn't like every Lebanese person. And especially because like my family is a Roman Catholic family and there's like kind of a sectarian divide at times. And being just among Lebanese Christians doesn't, I'm not always feeling like that's my lane. I really like the cosmopolitanness of bigger cities. And the times I felt most comfortable around very usually like dynamic, diverse, fluid groups. And that's all brought me to a point, you know, I spoke earlier about identities are really imagined. You know, a nation state is something imagined, a religion. I'm not saying that means it's fake. I'm saying it's something that you have to have belief. You have to have faith that it exists. And so absolutely, like for me, my communities have never been something that falls along a religious, national, identitarian, sectarian line. You know, it's been something that's where we have to lend each other a bit of a rope and find our way to the middle there. And so yeah, and I think that's something super important. So one of the things that I'm trying to work on now is envisioning communities based on these sort of, I don't want to say values necessarily, but identities. You know, how can we create cosmopolitan communities where we have a connected maybe motive or belief or something like that, that is not just about something identitarian.
Yeah, I think that's so important, especially in like the what I'm just going to generally refer to as the modern era, because relationships to family. I was listening to a podcast about nursing homes not that long ago where they were talking about nursing homes were created when people started moving away from their family, basically, right? And there were these old people who were left behind that needed care. And so they started out as something other than what they, at least in the United States, what they've become. And as somebody who's an only child, right, when my parents are gone, what is my community? Where is my support system? And as somebody who has friends all over the world, I'm like a little panicked, thinking like, my God, my support system is like kind of everywhere. And like, what if I really need something? Like, I have no like localized support system. So I think the idea of community for like the modern era is such an important topic that I feel like nobody's really talking about. And it's hard to have these conversations right now where everyone's like locked in their houses. But moving into the future, I think it's something that I hope more people are talking about and thinking about how to create those things.
Well, right. And I think the interesting thing about our modern, you know, period, what we're all going through, is that we're all, you know, we have all this technology to stay in touch, but in this essence, that also kind of keeps us from being where we're at, in a sense. So like, if I give an example, when I moved to Beirut, I mean, the internet there was horrendous at the time, but there wasn't like, I mean, I don't think WhatsApp had really taken hold in the US yet, like the way WhatsApp kind of is more ubiquitous now. But like in Lebanon, it was quite widely used, but in a very different way. And it's related to like cost of text messages and stuff like that, right? But like, if I'm talking about, you know, there was no like Facebook Messenger on your phone sort of thing. There was no, I don't think Instagram had really been created or even widely used. Like social, and it was different. Like you used Facebook, but you weren't always online. And also, you know, the internet there was super slow. So like, I wasn't able to, like, if you sent me a YouTube link, I couldn't watch it unless I let it download for like 6 hours. But what that did, you know, I couldn't call my friends anytime I wanted, you know, using WhatsApp call. I couldn't, you know, there was Skype and stuff like that. But again, like the way we interacted with our phones was very different. And all the technology was just like right before that period of like, boom, right? So what that forced me to do was like, yeah, it kind of threw me into a spiral of loneliness for a little bit, but it also kind of forced me to get out and like make connections and build a community in one place and make a group of friends. Whereas like now, you know, I moved to Italy in 2017 and went through a very similar spiral of like loneliness and kind of separated, being separate from my community. But like, you know, after noon, all my friends in DC were awake. You know what I mean? And suddenly we're, you know, the group chat is blowing up. And so I'm walking down the street, staring at my phone instead of looking what's in front of me. And I'm not saying that to be like, you know, there's great sides to the technology and stuff, but we're now able to stay in touch all the time with our favorite people, which is great and lends a level of support. But it also, I think, can become a blocker for really touching what's in front of us and really building up with the people around us in a way. You know, like there are days where I'm kind of ashamed to say this, but like there are days where like the interactions in Twitter are so alive in my head that I'm not talking to my friends who are around me, you know, and I've tried to become like aware of that and stop that. But it's, I mean, it can be difficult, you know, and like, again, like most of my best friends, if I think about the people in my life that I'm closest to, that I have the best relationships with, a very big majority of them are people I talk to using my phone or my computer.
So I have one last question for you that I always like to use to sort of wrap this up is, if somebody is out there listening to this episode, what do you hope their takeaway from your journey is?
Support matters. Community matters a lot. Actually, I couldn't do next to, you know, I've got a lot of ideas. I like to think I'm a creative person. I'm a person who's trying to challenge things and, you know, pull at different threads and piece them together in new, interesting ways that I feel like haven't necessarily been grappled with before. So a couple of things. One, that, you know, community really matters, and seek it and go for it and find it and look for it and build it yourself if you have to. Two, try things. Try, you know, if you have a bit of support and you have community and you make the right connections and there's something you want to do, try it. You might fail, but that'll make you better. Try not to like let that fear paralyze you. And I know that's like maybe really rich and easy to say. I think when you fail a few times and it gets a bit easier to take it, it like it still is hard sometimes. And sometimes you definitely need a dub. If you want something that you don't see out in the world and you feel like, try and create it, you know, there will probably be other people that are feeling the way that you're feeling. You know, you're not going to be as alone in that way. Yeah, I would say those two things. And there was a third that's honestly slipping me at the moment.
I think one of the things that I hear from your story is not to stop looking, like don't stop searching, because I think you said it earlier on that like you're never done searching for your identity, this like ethereal thing of identity. And so I think it's important to keep that search going, because I think sometimes people don't realize that when you stop, everything stops, right? Like you become stagnant. If you're like, this is what I am and I will not change, I will not grow, I don't need to look anymore. It's like, there's still things to learn. There's still things to experience that you might want to take in. Like we said before, I've only been watching football for 3 years, but it has become part of my identity now. And so if I hadn't been open to that 3 years ago, I would be a different person than I am now. So I think that's another part that I think is really important that I hope people are taking away when they're listening to you speak.
Yeah, and I think that's said a lot better than what I was trying to say. Yeah, and I guess just to add to that, it's like everything is kind of temporary, right? Just because you take a job, it doesn't mean it defines you. And what you're doing now can be something that you like doing now, and tomorrow you might want to do something different. And don't think that just because you did X before that you're going to do X in the future. You know, like you can shift, you can transition, and you can find new things. I mean, I guess the challenge I'm having here is trying to, because I'm honestly in a really blessed and like fortunate place right now. And that comes through like a mixture of factors, you know, including chance and good luck and work and everything else. But also like, I don't want it to be like, you too can do X, Y, Z, because there is a lot of chance in things. There is a lot of luck. There's, you know, following certain paths. I guess like maybe something I'd say is like, be open to what's coming at you. You know, in a way, is like there were times and jobs that I took where I was like, what am I going to get out of this? But yeah, you know, like you don't have to be at the end point. You don't have to be, I need to be at this company. I need to be at this status. I need to be in this location. Like maybe like redefine your goals. I think if at 25, I had an idea in my head that I wanted to work for the New York Times by the time I was 35, you know, or something like that. You know, I want to be at a legacy media. I want to be writing big stories. I want to be covering war zones. I want to be like an important thing. I'm not doing that at all right now. I think I'm much happier than I would have been if I'd stuck on that path. You know, part of that was just like seeing what kind of came to me. And I've changed a lot, but I've listened to those changes. I wasn't like, I have to stay with this because that's what I used to do. But again, I've been fortunate. So it's a mix of things. But yeah, absolutely. You know, keep searching, keep learning, keep being open, look for community, build community. And if you aren't finding it, you know, see if you can create it yourself and see if there's people around you who will help you do that.
I think that's a really good place to stop. I don't think we can get it any tighter than that. Thank you, Justin, for chatting with me about your story. It was awesome.
No, it's my pleasure. And I'm ready for the flip side of this when I turn it on you.
The poet Reeves remixed the talks of other speakers at TED 2006 into the poem Mockingbird, which ends with the line, "I'll listen for what's missing, and I'll put it there." As someone who longs for community, my conversation with Justin deeply inspired me to reach out to my friends and some people I didn't even know that well and say, "Hey, there's something I'm searching for. Maybe we can make that thing together." Even though I had all the conversations you've heard this season a year ago, they've helped me to take big leaps, even now. Over the past year, I became a dog mom. I changed jobs. I collaborated with my friends. I tried new things. I fell down, and I got right back up. Some of those things I had wished existed, I'm working to create right now. And I can't wait to see who I'll get to talk to and be inspired by a year from now. This episode's guest was Justin Salhani, writer, producer, and journalist. For more on Justin, visit his website, justinsalhani.com, and follow him on Twitter at Justin Salhani. You can also check out his videos on Oh My Goal's YouTube channel, Oh My Goal US. In the meantime, if you ever want to know what I'm up to, you can check out my website, jordanrizzieri.com, or follow me on Twitter and Instagram, at Jordan Rizzieri. Until next time, keep searching. Don't Talk to Me About Work is an independent podcast. Our managing producer is Jeremy Steinkamp, and our artwork was created by Ashley Steinkamp. I'm Jordan Rizzieri, executive producer and host.